I decided I want to learn about the women of early Castlemaine. So I decided to go to the experts. I went to Robin Anea, local and writer, and asked her, when I say the words women and Castlemaine, does anything particular come to mind? She immediately responded with, have you heard of Fanny Finch?
That's La Trobe University historian Casey Sinclair sharing the moment she first heard of English immigrant Fanny Finch, who sailed to Adelaide in the 1830s. Simultaneously, in another part of the country, Bill Garner was a descendant of Fanny and he was tracing his family tree, but he hit a roadblock. His great-great-grandmother, Cecilia Hotham, Fanny's mother, was penciled into the tree, but there were no records.
My mother fastened on the name Hotham because Hotham was, of course, the name of the governor at the time, which is quite possibly why Fanny actually chose that as the name for her mother. The family in general, I discovered, rather liked this notion that they might have sort of, you know, viceregal sort of connections. This is not unknown in family history. It turns out to be, of course, completely false.
Casey's interest in Fanny Finch and Bill's family research eventually crossed paths, and he learned something which profoundly altered his sense of identity. Fanny Finch's mother was not Cecilia Hotham. In fact, Fanny grew up in an orphanage in England. The story we're telling you today is about this little girl, now a grown woman living on the goldfields of Victoria, Australia, by then a single mother. It was 1852 and 25,000 men were digging for gold along a cold, muddy creek bed. Fanny offered a large, warm canvas tent with beds likely made of leaves and covered in bull hides to keep it warm. Along with a handful of women, somehow Fanny managed to dodge open mine shafts and drunken men, and she succeeded. But how did she end up there? Why was she described as the famous Mrs. Finch in the local newspapers? Why is she so admired by Castlemaine historians today? Well, you're going to find out. Thanks to Casey and Bill, her story has been made into a short stage play, which won a Victorian Community History Award in 2022. And this is a warning, the story does contain a brief mention of violence towards children. My name's Kate Follington and you're listening to the podcast Look History in the Eye, produced by Public Record Office Victoria, the archive of the state government. 100 kilometres of public records are preserved in climate-controlled vaults, and we meet the people who dig into those boxes, look history in the eye, and bother to wonder why. You can see records related to this story by searching Look History in the Eye podcast online.
I'm Alice Garner, and Fanny Finch is my great-great-great-grandmother.
I'm Alice's dad, Bill Garner, and Fanny is my great-great-grandmother.
And I'm Casey Sinclair. I'm doing a PhD on Fanny Finch.
But it's not just a family story.
Early in 1852, a woman pushing a wheelbarrow joins a long line of diggers on the road to Forest Creek. She has African heritage. A woman of colour, Fanny Finch, then 37, is a big, strong woman. She's heading for a camp packed with thirsty miners, where grog prices are sky high. Fanny had come out to South Australia as a domestic servant in 1837, just 1 month after Colonel Light had surveyed the site for Adelaide. There, she married a chainman survey party named Joe Finch. She left him in 1850 and took their children to Melbourne, children she had had to board out before leaving for the goldfields. It takes Fanny 4 days to get to Forest Creek digging. She sets up a tent that soon becomes very popular.
They call it the head centre and general resort of everybody, the only place of entertainment on the creek.
Even 40 years later, someone says, if anyone would hear her name now, no doubt they'd remember the many memorable nights had by her tent.
She's turning in plenty, people say.
Leapfrogging was profitable, but risky. You got a hefty fine. Fanny's tent was destroyed twice in 1 week.
And each time the police burnt it down, the diggers put up another one.
Fanny prospers at Forest Creek. In 1854, she moves her business into Castlemaine, expands it, and places a notice in the local paper.
Baths. Baths. Baths? What does she sound like? Baths. Mrs. Fanny Finch. Mrs. Fanny Finch begs respectfully to inform the inhabitants of Castlemaine, and diggers generally, that she has taken the undermentioned extensive premises, which she has furnished as a bathing establishment.
That's good. May I?
Please.
In offering this great summer luxury to her friends, Mrs. F. begs to assure them that no expense has been spared and that every regard has been paid to the comfort and convenience of bathers, and hopes to meet that encouragement and support which such an undertaking deserves.
A refreshment and reading room is attached where all the leading periodicals will be found, ladies and children carefully attended to by Mrs. F. personally.
Note the address, Templeton Street, next door to Messrs. Pye and Company's lemonade manufactory.
Come down to the baths. Bring your wives and your bums. Templeton baths, baths, baths. Wash the diggings dust away. Warm water, ash and tallow. Pye and Co's lemonade. Shilling for a shower, 4 shillings for a bath, 1 crown will make your dreams come true.
I didn't know what her accent would be like. I also knew that physically we were quite different. But I thought that if I spent time with her words, because she did write letters that are in the records, I might be able to make sense of her way of seeing the world. So that was my way in.
Fanny's bathing establishment proves costly. Then she gets a heavy fine for selling grog. In a letter to the Mount Alexander Mail, she boldly proposes a solution to her money worries.
If those who are in my debt would come forward, each with 1/3, I would be relieved of all my debts, have a good house for my family, and cash to put in my pocket. I also beg to state that, in spite of what enemies I may have, I intend to keep throughout the winter ready-cooked ham, beef soups a la mode, etc., from 7 in the morning till 7 at night.
She doesn't miss a chance.
She's not shy. Listen to this. A coloured lady attired in bright blue silk and artificial flowers. How good would it be to find a picture of that?
Any picture of her.
Fanny Finch must have been brave. Late one night, walking home, she hears screaming coming from inside a shop.
She bursts in, makes her way through to a bedroom.
She sees a man attacking a woman. She drags him off. She pushes him out of the room.
She bounces him on the counter and holds him till the police come.
The story appears in the Mount Alexander Mail. Everyone in Castlemaine hears about it. Fanny is known as a defender of women and children. Even back in Melbourne, in Bourke Street, when she had seen the continuing abuse of a 7-year-old named Mary Ann Bamford at the hands of her drunken parents.
Don't murder your child. You neglect her sufficiently without treating her with such cruelty.
She offers to pay for medical attention for Mary Ann.
I'll carry the girl to the hospital myself. I'll call the police if you don't help her.
By the time the parents take her to the hospital, it's too late.
Fanny testified at the inquest and then at the mother's trial for murder.
To see children abused, I will say my piece.
A strong-minded woman with a genuine tenderness of heart, which led her to be ever ready to serve another in distress, and that too without the slightest ostentation. No face, was more welcome at the Castlemaine Hospital, and not anyone, perhaps, was more charitable to its inmates. She was continually supplying them with creature comforts, and regularly, as Christmas came round, she furnished the whole female ward with a first-rate tea with all the necessary concomitants.
Not that it helps me when I get in there. I don't know where all the subscription money goes because the place is filthy. Holes in the floor, mice running everywhere. The matron is a monster. But nothing compared to the quack in charge.
You were ill?
A disease I won't mention. Then I go back in with a cough and they keep me there for more than 2 months. Inflammation of the lungs, they say. I don't know how I recovered.
You didn't. It's your obituary in the paper. You died.
Not yet. I've only just got started.
Fanny Finch died at the Castlemaine Hospital in 1863.
That quack killed me.
She was buried at Campbell's Creek, but without a headstone.
Like a pauper?
There's a headstone now, a beauty, paid for by the government.
On my grave?
Yes.
The governor did that?
Not the governor, the government.
The Minister for Women.
There's a Minister for Women?
Yes.
In 2020, the Minister for Women, Gabriel Williams, unveiled a very special headstone to mark Fanny's grave in acknowledgement of Fanny's contribution to women's history in Australia. And it's significant.
While running her business in Forest Creek, Fanny keeps her daughters in boarding school in Melbourne, but the kids are with her later in Castlemaine. Do they help with the Slide Rock?
It is a restaurant.
Sorry? Restaurant?
Thank you, young man.
Fanny was big on correcting the record. A notice in a local paper says she is required to apologise for insulting a Miss Miller.
I never.
She belts out a letter to the miners' right.
Sir, in the first place, I am not acquainted with a Miss Miller. In the next place, I am not in the habit of using any language likely to injure the character of any female, even as to require a private, let alone a public apology. So I will thank you to rectify the assertion to my satisfaction in next, Fanny Finch.
She's defiant.
They cause me endless trouble.
There was a sustained campaign against sly grogging. The £50 fine provided substantial revenue.
And the Jacks get a cut.
She's charged with sly grogging again.
Apart from a heavy fine, Fanny faces 4 months jail for failure to pay.
I have a lawyer.
She always has a lawyer.
Fanny is tried in the police court.
The Melbourne Argus calls her the notorious Mrs. Fanny Finch.
It's not just the sly grog charge.
The Mount Alexander Mail says the fair Fanny invited two policemen into her tent.
They were acting under orders, of course they were. We're playing four in hand, and the police join in. Goes on for 3.5 hours. They're playing for lemonade at first. Then they ask for a couple of nobblers, brandies. I know their game.
The police said Fanny produced a bottle from under the sofa. That wasn't a crime, as long as she received no payment. Her lawyer insisted that Fanny wouldn't be so stupid as to take money from police in uniform.
They swore they paid me after everybody else had left. They were lying.
The bench accepts the police story.
I appeal immediately.
Yes. At her appeal, Fanny is represented by her friend, Maurice McDonough.
I loved Maurice. A real fighter in court. Very good comic actor too. Drank himself to death. Very young.
McDonough's main line of argument was entrapment. He asked the police who sent them on the job. The judge told them not to answer.
Jackson.
The judge was likely protecting Edmund Jackson, the licensee of the Victoria Hotel, next door to Fanny's restaurant.
He pays people to dob in sly groggers.
Morris says, how can police spies be compared to someone of my good reputation? He calls them Vandemonians.
We call them Tasmanians now.
Why?
To clear up their reputation.
Vandemonians?
A police constable tells Fanny if they can't get her on the sly grog charge, they'll start a row and get her for keeping a disorderly tent.
My tent is never disorderly.
A disorderly tent was code for a brothel.
They want to drive me out of Castlemaine. If my word is not to be believed and the police continue to perjure themselves, then all I can do is appeal to the people of Castlemaine. Sir, I can scarcely tell you what I want to say, but write this letter as coming from myself, making notice of the time which is since Sir Diggins first opened, my having house, and at one time the only house either the commissioners or the diggers could be accommodated in. I've held a licensed refreshment tent ever since the diggings commenced, and can prove by any of my former neighbours that there never, and I believe the only tent that there was never even a quarrel in, and always conducted by myself. My neighbours on my right and at the back say they do not wish for a better neighbour, as does every neighbour I've had before, and are willing to prove it.
Except the neighbour on your left.
Everyone knows that.
Edmund Jackson.
Jackson's preferred target was unprotected females.
To whom must I look for protection? I'm compelled to seek it from someone, but cannot tell who. The head of police should certainly see into these sorts of affairs and not allow if two or three have a spite against an individual to be crushed just as they please. For I positively deny ever taking one shilling from the two constables for grog in any shape. Had not my witnesses, one I think but am not sure took a bribe to go to Melbourne, the other made drunk during the other trials, I could have convinced the public these men were perjured themselves. It looks to me very like a planned affair altogether. For I myself and others saw a constable whisper in one man's ear. In half an hour afterwards, he, the witness, was quite drunk. Is it not like treachery? And am I to have no redress?
I'd only seen a reference to this letter. The page was missing from the State Library's copy.
The State Library lost it.
I found it at the Castlemaine Historical Society. I couldn't believe it. It made me shout out.
Ecstasy in the archive.
I cried. In the week following Fanny's appeal, a long letter appeared in the mail under the pen name Constant Reader. Its writer insisted Fanny was being persecuted.
Mrs. Finch has a family to maintain and provide for and should be allowed every legitimate means of doing... and should be allowed to use every legitimate means of doing so as well as any other person. Means have been taken to entrap her into a violation of the law. Now, I believe I state correctly when I say that war is declared against her.
Someone finally says it in public. Was it Gus? Gus Yandel was often at my tent.
Even 40 years later, Gus remembers her with affection. The good times at Forest Creek. Would you be free for this dance, Mrs. Finch?
With pleasure, Mr. Yandel.
Two sly drug detectives have come up from town. They both roam about in disguise. For several retailers of drug are done brown, with reason to open their eyes.
I hope that other persons will corroborate my statement so that the persecuted party may no longer be under a stigma, as public opinion, biased by the police report, may tend to injure her business and family.
The support was important. Fanny steps up her public presence. And when the first Castlemaine municipal elections are held the following month, Fanny is determined to vote. Castlemaine held its first municipal elections in 1856. As the law was then, Fanny, as a ratepayer, was entitled to vote. Her nemesis, Edmund Jackson, was one of the candidates.
It's a pleasure to put a line through his name.
But election officials refused to count Fanny's vote or that of a female companion.
They threw out our votes. We are ratepayers. They say we have no right because we are women.
Parliament subsequently ruled that henceforth only male ratepayers would be eligible to vote. Thrown out or not, Fanny's vote was one of the first cast by a woman in Australia. Her voting slip is on display in the Castlemaine Art Museum. Someone kept it.
When leaders were sorted in the colony, there was one candidate quite unlabelly. The men of the town all had their say. A woman showed in blue satin on polling day.
Then, just a few months after Fanny tried to vote, the bailiff raids her place.
They trash everything.
Fanny writes to the paper again.
Sir, I have no doubt that you will not allow an oppressed woman to be treated with the cruelty I have experienced a few days since. Imagine, sir, the sheriff sending down the bailiff to seize upon my goods, and after almost ruining me, quietly saying that he had mistaken me for a person of another name. Surely, sir, there must be some protection for a woman endeavouring to support her children in decency.
She continues to suffer police persecution, and money is clearly getting tight.
Notice. Whereas a pretty little spaniel dog followed me home Saturday week, the owner can have it back by paying me £1 and the expenses of this advertisement. If he does not pay me by Monday, I shall sell it, as I was offered £5 for it and I cannot afford to keep it.
The owner lodges a complaint against Fanny for illegally detaining his dog.
She opens a restaurant in Amherst, but it burns down and she loses everything.
My little John died there. He was 12.
Fanny went back to Castlemaine. Records show her in the company of a number of Castlemaine businesswomen who ran so-called gay houses. It was not a fresh start.
We were getting by, me and the children. Then I go into hospital with that cough and you tell me I die.
That's right. 1863.
I'm what, 48?
But what a life!
Queen of the Main, you fed them and gave them a fine place to stay. You sat at the table, but they wouldn't let you play. So you took what was yours.
Casey's historical research has been able to shine a really important light on how Fanny was raised and educated, a young black woman in England. And what she discovered was an enlightening moment for Bill and Alice, connecting them unexpectedly to African slavery.
On her death certificate, Fanny's father is Captain Francis Jackson, Navy. Her mother is Cecilia Hotham. But actually, her mother was Lydia Holloway, a servant, and her father was a footman named John King. They were unmarried, and their baby was accepted into the London Foundling Hospital, a philanthropic orphanage. But her name wasn't Fanny. It was Louisa King.
Louisa?
And we even know when and where she was conceived.
I don't even know where Alice was conceived.
Bill?
It was the night of the Illuminations. Monday, August 1st, in the summer of 1814, London celebrates a century of Hanoverian rule and the defeat of Napoleon. The city is jumping. It's a huge event, There are fireworks and theatrics and amazing scenes all over London. People place candles in their windows. Servants are given the night off. It's all very exciting. And Lydia and John have sex in one of the public gardens.
I did that in Kew Gardens there in 1967.
Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.
We don't want to know, Bill.
In the middle of the day. The grass was rather prickly.
Casey, do you mean details like that can be found in the archive?
Incredible, isn't it? The process of admission involves full disclosure by the mother of all the circumstances of the birth. Fanny's mother, Lydia, has to tell them everything.
The race of the parents?
No. The Foundling Hospital has a policy of being colourblind.
So who does Fanny's colour come from?
Well, she seemed to think that both her parents were of colour.
Now, this is London in the early 1800s. Are Alice and I connected to slavery?
You most probably have an ancestor who was enslaved.
Something to think about.
If the archive is colourblind, how do we know that Fanny thinks both her parents are of colour?
The girls in the Foundling Hospital also samplers. On Fanny's embroidery, there are two people of colour, one standing on each side of a house. I've seen a picture of it. On the back, it says Frances Coombe, Foundling Girl, 15 years of age, 1830.
Coombe? Another name?
Baby Louisa King was rebaptised Frances Coombe by the Foundling Hospital. It was standard practice. Fanny just made up Captain Jackson and Cecilia Hotham.
And they're still there in the family tree.
But not Fanny.
How long was she in the orphanage?
I was there for 15 years.
Well, that must have been hard.
Well, how else would I have learned to read and write?
The Foundling Hospital took pride in educating children for a useful life. At 15, Fanny started an apprenticeship in household management. 6 years later, she gained a labourer's free passage to Adelaide. Frances Coombe arrived at the Tent Out of Adelaide in 1837. She was 22. 2 years later, she married Joseph Finch. Four children survived seven pregnancies. After she left Joe, Fanny declared him alive or dead as it suited her purpose. For a debt, he was alive. A social matter, she was a widow.
I tell people, Mrs. Finch begs to inform the local inhabitants that henceforth she will carry on business for her children. I am a woman endeavouring to support my children in decency.
By running a brothel, looks like.
You try raising four kids on your own and see what you do.
Respectability was out of reach for Fanny, but maybe not for her daughter, Mary Julia. In 1858, when she was 15 or 16, Mary Julia met a public servant named Oliver Warren Collins, your great-grandfather.
He spouts Latin. The father's a rector in West Yorkshire. There's Church of England ministers in the family going back 350 years.
He's firmly in the family tree.
Later, Mary and Oliver are married at the most fashionable church in Melbourne. Fanny records her written consent. There's no mention of her in the wedding notice.
Maybe I'm across the street, watching.
Joseph Finch gets a mention, but it says he's dead. Joe didn't actually die for another 35 years. In 1853, he was convicted at Buninyong of robbery in company and sentenced to 10 years on the roads, the first two in chains. At the time of the wedding, Joe is a ticket of leave man, stuck in Gippsland.
Oh, great. Some people come out as convicts. In our family, they come out and become convicts.
So Fanny takes Joe and herself out of the picture. She's constructing a new family.
A white one.
The one we thought we were.
I find it hard to believe that someone who, who was so vividly present in her own life, would erase herself like that.
That's my family history, Bill. Look, I think it's great that some white people don't see shame in connection to a coloured heritage, but it becomes more complicated when you look at it from the other side.
But at least you know who you are, Casey.
No, I don't. You think colour makes it clearer, Bill? My Indian and Sri Lankan heritage might be evident in my skin, but just like yours, my family history was whitewashed. It's the only reason my mother and father's families were even accepted into Australia. They had to prove they possessed as much white blood as they did South Asian. I have white privilege, just like you, and it was leveraged for gain, just as it was for you.
Yeah, but Casey, Alice and I haven't lived as persons of colour as you have. I mean, the danger for us, quite frankly, is to be self-congratulating about finding African heritage. But, I mean, can you be charged with appropriating your own family history?
Yes.
Ah.
Well, there's one thing we do agree on. Fanny Finch was an extraordinary woman. She defended women and children. She insisted on her right to vote. She spoke up against corruption and abuse of power. I haven't heard anything like that about any of our other ancestors.
Nope, no one. And frankly, it's a relief to embrace a brothel keeper after all that Anglican respectability.
We're all freer to claim Fanny now.
But we lost her for a long time.
I'm here, young William.
I'm so happy to have you in my family.
I'm happy you're in mine. I'm a great, 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 great grandmother now, I believe.
I'm so happy I found out about you before I died.
Turns out you can find out lots of things after you've died.
But it's not just a family story.
You were famous on the goldfields, Fanny Finch. Probably the first woman to publish in the local press, and one of the first women to cast a vote in Australia.
They threw out my vote.
You were unfailingly kind to and supportive of other women, and yet until recently, and perhaps in some people's minds, the taint of sex work clouds your reputation.
I was a ratepayer.
Your story isn't finished.
They tried to drive me out.
There are still so many gaps, ambiguities, mysteries.
I was lying in an unmarked grave.
With a headstone now.
What does it say?
Brave. Outspoken. Castlemaine's first businesswoman.
Really?
A pioneer of the district.
I can't tell you how important it is to find you.
Thank you. Thank you for looking for me.
Rise and fall on a London high tide, a future uncertain, courage a guide. Raven curls in the salty breeze, the gulls in the rigging cry, Francis, you're free. A sailor's bride in Adelaide, in your strong, fertile mind, bigger plans were laid. Miners thronged to the mother load, you packed your wheelbarrow and headed up the road. Oh, Fanny, queen of the main, you fed them and gave them a fine place to stay. You sat at the table, but they wouldn't let you play. So you took what was yours and showed us the way. Mm-hmm.
Well, Castle Main streets sparkled with gold and plenty of men to buy what she sold. A hearty meal, a roof over their heads, and all kinds of comfort in all kinds of beds. Standing for folks whose luck had been blown, a black woman like Grogger had troubles of her own. Fire and debt and a great deal of shade, she made a good living trading on a name. Oh, Fanny, Queen of the Main, you fed them and gave them a fine place to stay. You sat at the table, but they wouldn't let you play. So you took what was yours and showed us the way. When leaders were sought in the colony, there was one candidate quite unably. The men of the town all had their say. A woman showed in blue satin on polling day. All the valor, the grit and the gall to march down the street and stand in that hall. Well, you don't get no ballot if you don't got no balls, dear. She said, well, I got the right and I'll sign it right here. Oh, Fanny, Queen of the Main, you fed them and gave them shelter from the rain. You sat at the table, but they wouldn't let you play. So you took what was yours and showed us the way. Oh, Fanny, Queen of the Main, you fed them and gave them a kind place to stay. You sat at the table, but they wouldn't let you play. So you took what was yours and you showed us the way. Yeah, you took what was yours and you showed us the way.
That's the end of the stage play Finding Fanny Finch, originally performed at the Victorian Archive Centre in 2023 for International Archives Day. But stick around to hear a Q&A with the performers, historians Stacey Sinclair and descendants Bill and Alice Garner, who are going to be answering more really insightful questions from the crowd. The first question goes to the folk duo Friends of Wendy Cotton, who are the singers for today's performance, and they were asked about the song you just heard, Queen of the Main.
As mentioned earlier, it was surprisingly difficult to find an existing song with a suffrage theme, so we had this excellent opportunity to custom build one of our own for Fanny. And we had this amazing information that Casey had researched. And there's some great stuff in there. We sat down and talked about what we wanted to include. You know, there's the voting and there's the gold rush, there's fires, there's bad neighbours, there's a wheelbarrow. When I was thinking about how to describe Fanny in a song, I had this image of a strong, courageous leader who looked after the people around her, someone that they'd go to for guidance, someone who got around in big fancy dresses. So a real queen, a queen of her time and place, Queen of the Main, as in Castle Main. We're pretty excited when the others liked the song and it got included in the play. And we're particularly pleased when we played it at a rehearsal and Casey cried. I remember tearing up myself when I was writing the bit about Fanny turning up to vote. I was so grateful for her boldness in doing that and angry and sad that she might not have been met with the kind of respect that she deserved at the time. I feel like having that emotional connection to something
when you're writing it is going to make that emotion a bit more communicable when you go to share it with an audience. That's been such an amazing pleasure to help tell Fanny's story over the last couple of years.
Hi, thank you. Phenomenal. So my question is, I'm curious about what the husband, that she married, I was curious about what was his background and his race and the kind of the racial dynamics of that time for him, for her marrying.
Sure, thank you. Joe was an Anglo man. He was 5'8", fair skin, green eyes, had a tattoo of Fanny on the side of his arm. He didn't have a hole in his face. His son had a hole in his face. So he was an Anglo man. He was from a poor farming family from Hampshire. It seems as though his family released their first four children because they disappear from the records. And then from there they have another four children who continue to live in Hampshire and have families, and I can trace them to the 1910s. In fact, the youngest son, George Finch, goes looking for Joseph in the late 1890s and says, "My brother, Joseph Finch, who I never met, emigrated to South Australia in 1836, and we never heard from him again. Does anyone have any information?"
A couple of survey ships came out with Colonel Light, and he was on the other ship, and they were anchored at Kangaroo Island, first of all, and while they were there, Joe went off hunting by himself. After a couple of days, he didn't come back, and they sent out search parties for him, and they couldn't find him. And after another day or so, they gave up, and they were rowing back. They rowed back to the ship. They were unfurling the sails when they saw some blackfellas on the shore, waving frantically. They lowered the longboat, went back to the mainland, the shore, and there was Joe. The local Kaurna people had found him. He'd attempted to light a fire using gunpowder. This actually tells you a lot about Joe. And he'd blown himself up. He was badly burned, but he survived. In the longer version of the show, Alice thanked the Kaurna people of the Fleurieu Peninsula for finding him and bringing him to the shore, because otherwise we wouldn't be here.
I was researching William Wyatt. William Wyatt, with his wife Julia Wyatt, brought Fanny out from London, so she was their personal servant. In researching William Wyatt, who became the first protector of Aboriginals at that time, that story came up through William Wyatt, so I wasn't even specifically searching for Joseph Finch at the time. I suspect, so any contact that European people had with Aboriginal people at that time had to be recorded in some way through William Wyatt. So Joseph obviously had to go to William and explain what had happened, and then it was published in the paper. And it's possible that through that interaction, Fanny and Joseph met.
Just on that note, did you find out anything about the employers of Fanny's parents?
Yes, I did, yes. So I know that Fanny lived... Lydia Holloway was the servant to a man called Joseph Maberly, who was personal solicitor to Macquarie. So he was quite high up. He was also a personal solicitor to a man named... James Morley, who was also associated with the colonial campaign. Curiously, and I can't work this out, if anyone wants to have a crack at it, let me know if you have any luck, but Lydia lives with a James Morley when she gives Fanny to the Foundling Hospital, and I just find that to be a really interesting coincidence. James Morley was a bricklayer. I can't find anything about him. So, yeah, Lydia lived in a pretty high-standing house when she fell pregnant with Fanny. John King was the footman to a Salter, which was quite a high social standing at the time. So there's two pieces of evidence that I have to support the fact that she was African heritage. One is the DNA of the descendants who I've connected with through multiple lines. So I've connected with the descendants of Fanny's eldest daughter, and her family are big on testing, and they've consistently had West Coast results. Bill, also, your cousin, he had West Coast, she had West Coast, yeah. The other piece of evidence is that a poem is written on board the John Renwick, which is the ship that Fanny sailed from from London. And on board was an artist by the name of Teresa Chauncey. She's quite a famous sculptor with her sister Martha. She wrote a poem and she refers to Fanny as an African woman. So they're the two pieces of evidence that I have. Yeah.
Thank you all. That was really remarkable. Casey, do later suffragettes acknowledge Fanny in any way? And secondly, do you have any understanding of how the ballot slip is at the Castlemaine Art Museum?
Is that Naomi?
Yes. Hi. I work there.
Yes. okay, so no, in short, they did not. Don't think they really acknowledge women of colour or the efforts of working class women at all. So no, unfortunately not that I've found. The fact that the ballots survive is really interesting. It was retained by David Preshaw, who was a doctor in Castlemaine at the time and started the Castlemaine Hospital. I suspect that the reason that the ballots survived is because those early pioneers thought they were pretty cool. They were like, we've started this town, we need to celebrate ourselves. And so they were actually data collecting from really early on. And so the fact that the first municipal election collection was saved is unsurprising because of the pedestal that they kind of put themselves up quite early. No other collection of ballots have been saved, from my understanding. This was the one and only. Fanny voted alongside another woman who was unnamed in the Argus. I can't find her name in those ballots, largely because most of them are illegible. I have a feeling most people were drunk when they voted. A lot of the signatures kind of go off the page. So if that woman is there, I can't read her name. I haven't identified it. Marjorie Theobald has a few theories about who that woman was based on the rate books at the time. There were only three or four women paying rates that Marjorie thinks would have been bold enough to cast a vote. Her name was Catherine Gorman, I believe, yeah. She was the publican of the Tarradale.
Bill and Alice, you said that Fanny's been written out of your family tree. Who's sitting there instead?
Frances Jackson and Cecilia Hotham are sort of penciled in. One of the reasons I started investigating this part of our family history and that led me to Casey was that I knew that my great-grandmother had been born in South Australia quite early on. There was an indication of that, but no information. It was pencil and then nothing, right? So, and I do know that my mother fastened on the name Hotham because Hotham was, of course, the name of the governor at the time, which is quite possibly why Fanny actually chose that as the name for her mother. The family in general, I discovered, rather liked this notion that they might have sort of, you know, viceregal sort of connections. This is not unknown in family history. It turns out to be, of course, completely false. I think one of the things it's interesting is that this secret was kept in the family for, you know, 150 years. And they had social reasons for being secretive, whatever they'd known. And that it's a great coincidence that the research that Casey's done has arrived at a moment when a family is capable of taking it on board.